The fool says in his heart, there is no God. Psalm 14, I think I heard some of you mentioning that earlier. It's there at the beginning of Psalm 53 as well. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. The trouble is, that's not what it looks like. That's not what it feels like. Those who say there is no God don't seem to be foolish. And we're not talking about intelligence. There are very many clever atheists. The verse does not say, the fool says in his mind, there is no God. Instead, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. And that's much more searching, isn't it? Lots of people might acknowledge God in their minds. They might believe that there is a God. And yet their hearts be saying that there is no God. That is, their desires or their choices or their priorities take no account of God. They're saying, their heart is saying, there is no God. Trouble is, it's still not what it looks like, is it? We all know people who seem to be very wise and sensible and yet take no account of God at all. In fact, sometimes the thing that looks foolish is taking God too seriously. We say they're getting carried away, or they're taking things too far, getting things out of proportion. So perhaps we might feel some sympathy with Saul in this story this evening. You'll remember the people have asked God for a king, like all the other nations. Well, that was dodgy right from the word go. They were not supposed to be like all the other nations. More than that, by wanting their own king, they were rejecting God as their ruler. Well, God grants their request, and the man he chooses seems to have leadership potential written all over him. We're told that he is an impressive young man without equal among the Israelites. And he was, first of all, privately anointed by Samuel. And then in chapter 10, he was publicly made king. And then in chapter 12, Samuel makes his farewell speech. His leadership is giving way to the reign of Saul, the first king. But in that speech, Samuel reminds them that it is the Lord who is really on the throne. He's the one that all of them, including the king, should be serving. So here we are, at the start of chapter 13, the official beginning of kingship in Israel. Here's the formal announcement of the reign of King Saul in verse 1. But there's a little bit of a problem there. We see from the footnote that later manuscripts have added in a 30 and a 40. What the original actually says is that Saul was a son of a year when he became king, and that he reigned for 2 years. Now that phrase, son of a year, might not refer to his age, but how long he had been king in waiting. That is, since he'd been anointed by Samuel. And the reign of 2 years might not refer to his entire reign, but his time on the throne until that point when God rejected him as king, which we'll discover happens rather soon, as soon as chapter 15. Well, if that's so, then by referring to this reign of 2 years, the writer is highlighting the tragedy that is about to unfold. It'll all be over in 2 years. After all the preparation, after all that the Lord has done to limit the damage of that demand for a king, that he would not be like all the other nations, and the vision of the possible future that Samuel has set before them, after all of that, yet it would only last 2 years. It seems that verse 1, the flag is already flying at half mast. Now, to understand this chapter 13, we need to remember two instructions that were given to Saul when he was first anointed back in chapter 10, a year or so before he officially became king. Instruction number 1 comes in chapter 10, verse 7. Do whatever your hand finds to do, for God is with you. And that doesn't mean do whatever you like. Rather, it means get on with the job that has been given to you. Now, earlier, God had said that he was choosing Saul to deliver Israel from the Philistines. And Samuel has just told him that there is a Philistine outpost at Gibeah. So get on with the job means get rid of that Philistine outpost. Start tackling that Philistine threat. That was first instruction. Second instruction from Samuel comes in the next verse of chapter 8. Go down ahead of me to Gilgal. I will surely come down to you to sacrifice burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, but you must wait 7 days until I come to you and tell you what you are to do. So when he'd defeated that Philistine outpost, he was then to wait for further instructions from Samuel. Well, so far, here at the start of chapter 13, Saul hasn't done anything about either of those instructions. Both of them are still in his in-tray, and they've been there for over a year. Now, given that continuing Philistine threat, it's no surprise that the first thing we're told about Saul's reign is the formation of his army. Verse 2, 2,000 with him as their lead, with Saul as their leader, and 1,000 under his son Jonathan. And surprisingly, it is Jonathan who starts that long-awaited attack upon the Philistine outpost. Surely we should be asking, well, you know, where's Saul? What's he been doing? This instruction has been in his in-tray for a year. And eventually it is Jonathan who picks it up. And when he does, we're told the Philistines heard about it. Well, that doesn't sound too good. It doesn't take a genius to work out that they won't be happy and will be plotting revenge. And so verse 3, Saul had the trumpet blown throughout the land. And notice that in those news bulletins, it's now Saul who gets the credit for attacking the Philistines. But the situation is very serious. Israel has become an offence to the a stench to the Philistines. And the Philistines launch a full campaign. Verse 5, in the original Hebrew, it's 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore, a massive Philistine army that can't be counted. The Israelites are hugely outnumbered. It is a terrifying situation. And not surprisingly, the sight of that vast army was too much for the men of Israel. Verse 6, some of them begin to slip away, to go into hiding, to sneak across the border, away from the terrible onslaught that is about to happen. But not Saul. He was the king. He remains in Gilgal, as Samuel has told him, with those who've not yet slipped away, right behind him, trembling with fear. Saul has remembered Samuel's instruction, and he took it seriously. Verse 8, he waited for 7 days, the time set by Samuel. Each day, the Philistine advantage was growing, as more and more Israelites slipped away. But Saul waited. 7 days. Each day he must have been anxiously asking, has anyone seen Samuel? 7 days holiday can go by a flash, can't it? But these 7 days, I'm sure they didn't. Each day the anticipated arrival of Samuel did not happen. End of the seventh day approached, and there was still no sign. All the time the situation was getting worse and worse. And verse 8, the men were scattering. How many of them were left of those he started with? Yet Samuel was nowhere to be seen. It was a desperate moment. If he waited any longer, he might not have any army left at all. You can almost hear him urgently asking around on day 7, where's Samuel? Anyone seen Samuel? Anyone heard anything of Samuel? There was no answer, no sign of Samuel. And then that desperate moment, Saul decided that he must act. Verse 9, so he said, bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offerings. And Saul offered up the burnt offering. He used his initiative. He did what Samuel was going to do if he'd been there. What alternative was there? If he let his army disperse altogether, then the Philistines could just walk in and slaughter whoever they wanted. What kind of a king would he be then? Instead, he took decisive action to prepare for the coming conflict. Don't you feel a good amount of sympathy for Saul? He did what he had to do. At the very moment that he completed the sacrifice, what happens? Verse 10, Samuel arrives. I imagine at first Saul was relieved. Samuel would know what to do. He dealt with the Philistines before. But any relief quickly disappears. What have you done, asked Samuel? Like God asking Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, what have you done? Can you see the confusion on Saul's face as he replies, when I saw that the men were scattering and that you did not come at the set time and the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favour, so I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering. What choice did I have? The men were scattering, and I had no idea where you were, Saul, and I couldn't go to war without seeking the Lord's favour. You ask, what have you done? I've done the only thing I could do. How was I supposed to know that you were about to appear? And anyway, why did you leave it till the last minute? But if Saul expected a sympathetic hearing from Samuel, he was badly disappointed. Verse 13, you acted foolishly. What an unreasonable thing to say. What was foolish about what he'd done in such desperate circumstances? Surely it would have been more foolish to have done nothing. Samuel continues, you acted foolishly. You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. And that, according to Samuel, is the behavior of a fool. It's what only a fool does. He had not kept the command that the Lord had given to him. Do you feel the weight of this as the story comes to us? For Saul to obey God was an extraordinary thing to ask in the circumstances. It seems completely unreasonable. It required him to trust God against every instinct, against every bit of evidence, every aspect of his situation. The Philistines coming in massive numbers, the Israelites melting away, everyone terrified. What was he supposed to do? It's a huge mistake to think that obeying God will always be the easy thing to do, or the comfortable thing to do. Trusting God is rarely straightforward or simple. Often we don't see the wisdom of obeying God from just looking at the circumstances. Can't see the foolishness of disobeying God from the circumstances. What Saul did seemed sensible, not foolish. Often it will look foolish to obey God and to trust God. If we simply do what circumstances seem to be telling us to do, we'll often end up doing the foolish thing. The foolishness of disobedience and the wisdom of obedience will only be seen when we take into account something more than just the circumstances. Samuel continues, "If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time." Only in the light of God's promise do we see the foolishness of what Saul did. By circumstances alone, Saul's actions seem wise and prudent. But in the light of God's promise, it was the most foolish thing that he could have done. Trusting God means that we're not living by sight alone, but in the light of his promise. So whether Saul's action was helpful or not is irrelevant. What matters is that it forfeited the promise of God. Well, Samuel spells out the consequences. "But now your kingdom will not endure. The only king who can rule God's people is a king who himself is obedient to God." But how can such a king be found? Well, verse 14 continues, "The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people, because you have not kept the Lord's command." That expression, a man after God's own heart, have almost become a bit of sort of Christian jargon, talking about a person with a God-centered heart. But the original does not mean that at all. It's actually saying the Lord has sought for himself a man according to his own heart. It's about the place that this man has in God's heart, rather than the place that God has in this man's heart. It's talking about God's heart, that God has chosen someone according to his own will and purpose. See, Saul is the king that the people had chosen for themselves. Yes, he's sometimes described as the man that the Lord had chosen, but it was based on the people's demand for a king in the first place. Well, all of that is about to change. The Lord has chosen a king for himself, entirely as he chooses. And we'll meet that person, David, later in the story, of course. So the difference between King Saul and King David is not to be found in their heart. Rather, it's the different place they have in God's heart. And any Christian, if they're honest, would have to say the same about ourselves and our non-Christian neighbours. My salvation is not because my heart is better than someone else's. It isn't. But rather, wonderfully, graciously, I have a place in God's heart. He has chosen to set his love upon me. And the same goes for all who belong to Jesus. That's the big difference between Saul and David. David will be the man of God's choosing. But see where Israel has got to? With this foolish king that they have chosen? The army, verse 15, has shrunk to 600 men. The Philistines are able to send out their raiding parties, verse 17, north, west, east, almost at will. And Saul is powerless to do anything about it. The Israelites are prevented from making any weapons, verse 19. They depend on the Philistines to have even their farming equipment sharpened under the hefty profit. So verse 22, on the day of battle, the battle that has been looming ever since Jonathan attacked that Philistine outpost. Well, how much of a battle will it be? Not only massively outnumbered, the Israelites hardly have any weapons. So the scene is set for the next chapter, but it's not looking good, is it? Military disaster seems inevitable. But here's the thing that is always difficult for us to see. The really fearful situation for Saul and the Israelites was not the Philistines. The really fearful thing was the disobedience of their king. God had made it clear through the prophet that what he required of his king and his people was their obedience. We find that hard to recognize because we're so like Saul. We sympathize with him because we too find that to fully trust God is difficult. To obey God fully is beyond us. When circumstances are not favorable, or when it means going out on a limb, when it means going against the wisdom of the world. Tragically, King Saul is in no position to help his people because of his disobedience, his lack of trust. He was, like the rest of us, a fool. But, we have a different king. The New Testament bursts with the news that the perfect king, the king who is faithful all the way to the apparent foolishness of a cross, has come. This king is no fool. Thankfully, he is not like Saul, not like us. He was the perfectly obedient one. And we can ride on the coattails of his perfect obedience, his perfect faithfulness. As the writer of Hebrews says, during the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. And so he says, let us approach the throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Yes, the obedient king has come. And in him we have a sure and certain hope.